From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
The main idea in the budget is this. At a time when our economy is growing and creating jobs at a faster clip, we've got to do everything in our power to keep this recovery on track.
Coming up on Forum this morning, President Obama's $3.8 trillion budget proposal calls for hiking taxes on the rich and spending more on transportation, infrastructure, and economic stimulus programs. The chair of the Senate Republican Policy Committee, John Barrasso of Wyoming, says the budget doesn't stand a chance of approval and that President Obama is playing politics.
Somebody asked me if this budget was dead on arrival. I said, no, it's not dead on arrival. It's debt on arrival.
We debate the budget and discuss its potential impact on California next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, President Barack Obama released his budget proposal for the 2013 fiscal year, and the proposal calls for aggressive spending to boost growth and higher taxes on the rich, and is being criticized by Republicans from many quarters who are opposed to higher taxes and see the proposal as a failure to curb the deficit, despite the promise by the president to cut over $6 billion of the national debt over the next decade. Whether it can move past Republican-dominated legislators remains to be seen, but there is strong opposition already, and some, like Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, are calling it a political document. We want to discuss the economics and politics of the president's proposed budget in this Forum Hour. And joining us from Washington to speak first with us is Michael Doyle, who's a reporter with the Washington Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers. And Michael Doyle, good to have you with us back on Forum. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I want to mention also just a few details for listeners. This 2013 budget proposal asks for $800 billion for job creation and about $476 billion for infrastructure, as well as 30% tax on millionaires, the so-called Buffett rule. So do we have a political tool here or a spending plan?
Well, every budget's a combination of both politics and economics, all the more so weighted toward politics in this election year. It sets the first parameter for the debate that's going to proceed on Capitol Hill for the next couple of months, which is the priorities, what priorities of spending each party wants to pursue. We shouldn't think that this document is unusual in being called dead on arrival. Every president's budget is called dead on arrival, regardless of whether his party is in or out of power on Capitol Hill. Every lawmaker wants to put their own stamp on the budget, and this year is just going to be more of that same.
Isn't the president saying in his budget, in effect, I'm going to spur job growth, the wealthy are going to pay more taxes, the Democrats are the guardian of the safety net, and I'm the guardian of the middle class?
Well, certainly, that's the coherent message that the president and his economic/political team want to convey, and I think the Republicans, when they come out with their budget, whether it's from Paul Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee, or others, will be presenting a different budget, perhaps, or a different message, one of austerity, of aggressively attacking the nation's debt, of aggressively bulking up the nation's national security infrastructure. So each party will use the budget to convey a certain message toward the voters, and the president's does slant toward jobs and protection of the domestic agenda.
The Republicans, for the most part, are saying this is a lot of retreads and it doesn't cut enough, and yet President Obama, of course, is putting a different spin on it, along with the Democrats, saying there are difficult cuts in this proposal. In fact, as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Michael Doyle, there are about 210 federal programs being cut in this budget. Every department will feel the impact.
That's correct. There are more than 200 cuts and consolidations identified. The Republicans are correct when they say that many of these are retreads. Here's a classic example that has a big impact in California. This president, like every other president, has proposed cutting a program that reimburses states for incarcerating illegal immigrants. Every time this happens with a new budget coming from the president, Congress will restore some of that money, what's called the SCAP program. But there are dozens and dozens of similar programs that every year presidents purport to eliminate and Congress adds back in. So there is a degree of artifice involved with any effort to propose spending cuts.
That particular cut would be one example of a great impact on California were it to go through.
Well, yeah, California spends roughly $1 billion a year incarcerating in state prisons and county jails illegal immigrants, and so it had pushed hard under then-Governor Pete Wilson a long time ago for this state criminal alien assistance program. And every year, members of the California delegation unite across party lines to get more money for it. But presidents find it an easy one to purport to cut. As I say, there's a degree of theatricality involved. Nobody expects what the president proposes in terms of the dollar amounts to survive to the end of the day.
Michael Doyle, reporter with the Washington Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers. So Michael, get you to talk a little bit more about the impact on California. I know certainly Central Valley farmers would be affected with fewer subsidies.
Well, they would be, but talk about artifice. As they have in the past, the Obama administration officials have again proposed eliminating what are called direct payments, which are a form of crop subsidy. Members of Congress who represent agricultural states are very loath to reduce payments to their farmers. Direct payments in particular are politically popular in some circles. And so although there's a said to be savings from eliminating direct payments to cotton and rice farmers and others, this is going to face a very much an uphill battle in Congress. But when you think that California receives more than $300 billion a year in federal spending of various sorts, clearly any time Congress or the White House agree on a budget plan, twirl the dials in one direction or another, it's going to have a big impact on California, whether it's a National Science Foundation grants being going to the University of California or water projects for the poor of Oakland.
Or investing $2.5 million in community college students, which certainly has its impact here in the Golden State. But let's talk about some of the other things. I mean, there are smaller block grants for Valley counties. There's essentially money being taken away to clean California beaches. There's a good deal of money taken away from constructing national park facilities. I mean, there's a real impact for California here.
Well, there is, but there's both giving and taking. At the same time as there are many of these suggested cuts, there are proposals to buy several hundred acres of fish and wildlife refuge land in the Central Valley, buy several hundred acres of small rocks and islands off the California coast, build the National Wildlife Refuge projects in the San Pablo National Wildlife Refuge. There is, as you mentioned, the community college program. There are 2.5 million community college students in California, and they would presumably be among the beneficiaries of the administration's big-ticket item, an $8 billion plan to help train community college students in high-growth jobs. So it's relatively easy to focus on the big winners and the big losers. In the totality, California perhaps ends up being a wash compared to other states. We couldn't really say that California is a big loser in this budget any more than any other state.
Well, when the president gave his State of the Union speech, and we talked about that, there was essentially a kind of carrot and stick threat from him about curbing college tuition increases. And I guess we see some efforts in this budget. There's an $8 billion fund to forge partnerships between community colleges and businesses. And again, this would presumably create more jobs.
Well, that's the theory. And from the political lens as well, you can see where this would be a very attractive message for the president and his party to send. They're the party that wants to boost job training, that wants to boost education, and that's something that they're going to want to present. And this is where budget and political interest align themselves in this election year, in the same way as Republicans perhaps might want to support continued funding for the construction of the Global Hawk unmanned reconnaissance vehicle built by Northrop Grumman in Southern California, based at Beale Air Force Base outside Sacramento. Republicans can align their budget and defense priorities by supporting that project, which the president wants to end.
Let's talk politics for just a moment, Michael Doyle, because this may not be dead or dead on arrival, but it's going to be awfully difficult to get this past the GOP legislators, particularly pledges to cut $10 billion in tax breaks for oil, gas, and coal producers, or for that matter, to raise taxes with the so-called Buffett rule, based on Warren Buffett's actually paying less taxes than his secretary. Raising taxes to 30%, I mean, there are Republicans who have signed essentially oaths in blood that they will not in any way move to raise taxes under any circumstances.
It is impossible to see any path that this budget has to completion. The House is of course, controlled by Republicans, and the Senate, although Republicans are a minority, they've maintained through the parliamentary tools at their disposal, they have considerable authority as well. There's no doubt that the appropriations bills that will be passed that keep the government operating for the fiscal year and the overall budget is going to be drastically different in the end than what the president is proposing today. But that's not to say what the president is proposing is irrelevant. It sets out, as I said earlier, a parameter for the discussions to come, and it gives the Republicans and Democrats something to bounce off of.
It becomes a negotiating tool, essentially.
Well, it stakes out a position. The Republicans will stake out theirs, and this happens every year. At the end of the day, the parties will have to, because of the divided government, will have to come to some form of agreement, no matter how bitter they may sound at the end, on what the final spending numbers will be.
We also have the reality that about half of the federal budget, is exempt, because we're talking about Social Security, Medicare, and that's going to be the real battle. Republicans want more taken away from entitlements, but where are you going to take them when you have essentially a ceiling on cuts?
Well, that is an important point. Entitlements of the sort that you mentioned are the driving factor behind the deficit, and they're the big elephant in terms of federal spending overall. The president, from my reading of it, essentially punts on any serious effort at entitlement reform. And in the bitterly partisan realm on environment and capital, it's impossible to imagine that the parties could agree on getting together with entitlement reform in the same way as they did in 1995 on welfare. So much of the serious discussions have been put off to another day, or in fact another year.
Big battles over defense and high-speed rail. I mean, you can almost outline where a lot of the battles are going to be, but I want to just get your take on something the president spoke about more recently, offering to continue the payroll tax cut without demanding that its costs be offset by other budgetary cuts. A number of Democrats are reluctant to separate payroll tax cut extension from unemployment benefits, and they want them acted on at the same time. And the president just this morning said he was surrounded by a lot of individuals at the White House saying these people exemplify who would benefit from the tax cut.
Well, and just today, Politico, which is a newspaper inside the Beltway in Washington, and other news organizations are reporting that House Republicans seem to be backing off their prior insistence on paying for the payroll tax cut, which seems to be creating an avenue toward a deal on that. Whether there's linkage or not to extending unemployment benefits is another matter. But in terms of one of the real core impediments to a deal on the payroll tax cut, it does appear that the House Republicans have backed off their prior position. And so that's probably one step closer for a completion on that.
Michael Doyle, we appreciate very much you being with us, and thank you.
My pleasure.
And Michael Doyle, reporter with Washington Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers. Joining us from Washington also this morning, Alan Viard, economist, resident scholar with the American Enterprise Institute, former senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and a senior economist on the staff of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. Alan Viard, good to have you here. Good morning.
Thanks. Good to be here.
We also have Jared Bernstein with us, senior fellow in the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Jared Bernstein also with us from Washington this morning, and welcome, Jared Bernstein.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Good to have you. And Alan Viard, let's begin with your take on this budget. Too light on the deficit reduction, I imagine, is pretty much what we're hearing from, the conservative wings.
Yeah, it's not surprising, of course. I mean, I thought Michael Doyle gave a good summary of the situation. I mean, with the partisan atmosphere that we have today, it's probably unrealistic to think that President Obama would have set out a budget plan that would really resolve the long-term fiscal imbalance. We know that's only going to happen when both parties come together at some point on an agreement to really tackle taxes and entitlements. But what we're seeing here is really largely similar to the president's previous initiatives. There's very little in the way of entitlement benefit cuts. There's no broad-based tax increases. There's tax increases on high-income groups and almost an exclusive focus on that. The The president even doubled down. This is the one surprising feature of the budget, I guess, but he's doubled down in one respect on that strategy because the dividend tax hike that he's proposing in this budget plan is much, much larger than the change that he proposed in last year's budget or the budgets before that or during the 2008 campaign.
Can you say something about what essentially will be the House Republicans offering a budget? The expectation is that they'll offer a budget which would have in it a major overhaul of Medicare. This is pretty much Congressman Paul Ryan's voucher program that we're talking about.
It is. Yeah, no, I think the Republicans in the House will come up with a budget resolution. It looks like the Senate will not, and therefore, of course, no budget resolution will ultimately be enacted. But I think the House probably will pass one. It will look, in many respects, I think, like last year's. It will have the Medicare voucher slash premium support, but probably a little bit more generous in terms of the extent of funding allowed for that program. Probably include, again, the idea of a Medicaid block grant to the states. There'll be nothing on the tax side. And so I think, as Michael Doyle was saying, what you'll really see here is both sides kind of laying out their agendas. Not really any negotiation between the two parties this year, but just putting out those agendas and I guess heading into the elections and let the voters render some kind of verdict.
Well, Medicare is an interesting example because, as we spoke of with Michael Doyle, entitlements will be probably a centerpiece of the haggling and fighting that's going to go on every partisan level. But the president has in his budget $360 billion in reductions to Medicare and Medi-Cal.
Yeah, he does. There's some good measures here on Medicare. Now, some of them are attempts to just make medical care cheaper. And, hopefully, of course, that can be done to some extent. But both political parties really put too much hope on that, I think. What we really have to do to curb these programs is to simply restrict the extent of governmental funding to reduce the amount of costs that are shifted from the private sector to the government sector. But the president, to his credit, has some proposals that do just that. He's got some proposals to expand cost sharing under a couple of different aspects of Medicare. He proposes higher Medicare premiums for high-income beneficiaries. He proposes to increase premiums under Part B Medicare for people who buy supplemental coverage that would prompt them to use more services. So these are actually sensible measures. They're very modest in scope, but I would like to think, I'd like to hope that there could be some bipartisan action on those measures.
Alan Viard, again, is an economist and resident scholar with the American Enterprise, and Jared Bernstein is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And Jared Bernstein, let's talk about partisanship. Mitch McConnell says this is a campaign document. John Boehner says this is a collection of rehashes, gimmicks, and tax increases, and well, Mitt Romney calls it an insult to the American taxpayer.
Yeah, that's all just political noise. I wouldn't pay much attention to it. I think the discussion that we've had so far, both with Alan and with the journalist, actually shows that there's a lot of substance here. By the way, the fact that something was introduced before, particularly in this Congress, where pretty much nothing gets anywhere, is not a criticism. A good idea that doesn't get enacted 6 months ago is still a good idea. And I thought the discussion you just had with Alan was particularly interesting regarding entitlements. I mean, a lot of people go around this town shaking their hands and rending their garments, arguing that nobody's dealing with entitlements. Now, you can absolutely criticize the president for not going far enough, but he's gotten way outside most Democrats' comfort zone in what I think is a very bipartisan effort to actually put entitlements on the spending cut table. By the way, some of those cuts go too far for me. I actually don't see how, and a state like California, folks there might agree, I actually don't see how you cut Medicaid spending. It's a very tight program in terms of its budget, and not start to hurt poor beneficiaries. But there are savings to be had in Medicare. And again, maybe one can argue it doesn't go far enough. But I think there's actually a lot in this budget that if we were in a more kind of rational environment, and we're pretty far from that, people would be taking a pretty close look at.
Well, there is a lot of talk from the GOP about budget gimmicks and essentially even saying that maybe some of the figures that are been put out by the administration in this budget are bogus figures. They're talking, for example, about $800 billion in war savings as not necessarily being a realistic way of computing.
Okay, so that's really an interesting point. It is. I would stipulate that there is some gimmickry there. By the way, it's gimmickry that both sides have used in their budgets. So a pox on everyone on this. But here's the thing. put aside, again, the political noise and look at what's happening here. The government itself, the OMB, that's the Office of Management and Budget that writes the budget, as well as the Congressional Budget Office. They're the nonpartisan scorekeeper. They plugged in hundreds of billions of dollars for wars for the next 10 years. And the idea was that we better put this in our budgets in case we use it. Well, because of the wind down of Iraq and some of the drawing down that's planned in Afghanistan, some of those numbers that were plugged in, everyone knows, won't be used. So the Congressional Budget Office, again, nonpartisan scorekeeper, says, okay, those are savings that you could now use for deficit or something else. I definitely get the gimmickry accusation, and there's something to it. But the fact is that it is money we were planning to spend and that we're not going to be spending now. So I can see where you'd want to apply it to better uses, including deficit reduction.
Well, Alan Viard, is it hyperbole when we're hearing from Republicans that there's really no substantive reform for mandatory and entitlement spending in this budget?
I think saying there's no substantive reform, I mean, I think that is close to right. Again, I don't want to get bogged down in semantics here because there are some sound measures, like I said a minute ago, and I really hope the Republicans will look at those and try to take action on them. There's clearly no restructuring of the entitlement programs, and we know that will eventually have to happen. Now, realistically, that is only going to happen as part of a bipartisan agreement. So I don't think anybody was really expecting that the president was going to step out on a limb alone and say, here's my proposal to restructure entitlement programs. So, you know, I'm not, you know, trying to throw stones at him because he didn't do this, but I think it's a correct statement to say that he did not do that. There's no basic restructuring here of the entitlement programs. There's a few modest measures that do go in the right direction that I hope do get acted on.
And what do you think, Jared Bernstein, the likelihood is that we'll get a bipartisan agreement as opposed to this just languishing or just seeing loggerheads?
More languishing and loggerheads than bipartisan agreement on the budget. I mean, you have to understand that these folks are you know, arguing tooth and nail about whether and when to turn the lights off at the close of business. Every single small program now that used to be kind of de facto just dealt with, it now becomes a source of contention. So I don't look for much compromise there. I think earlier it was stated that these documents do frame the discussion, and that's true. One point on structural reform: the Affordable Care Act. It's easy to forget that is the law of the land. Okay, that has been legislated. People might not like it. It might not be as successful as we hope it will be. The Congressional Budget Office tells us it will save over $1 trillion over the next couple of decades. That could be wrong, but again, that is what the scorekeepers tell us. That is a very serious and deep restructuring of our public health care system. I'm not saying it's the be-all, end-all. I'm not even saying it's going to work as planned. But we do have structural health care reform. I actually think it's a good plan.
There's a lot to talk about in this $3.8 trillion budget proposal. In fact, it's over 1,200 pages, and I'm going to open up the phone lines and invite you, our listeners, to join us with any questions or comments you might have, and not only talk about the specifics of the budget, but also generally whether we're talking about, well, how much of it is political and how much of it is actually a spending plan that's going to be negotiated and worked through. Where do politics override the economics, and how do the two hybridize or not? I'm going to give you, our listeners, a toll-free number to call. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can join us now. And that toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, the number for your calls, 866-733-6786. There are other ways to communicate with us. And to send us your questions or comments, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or go to our Facebook page. We welcome your involvement in the program, so please feel free to be involved. We spoke earlier with Michael Doyle, reporter with the Washington Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers, and with us for the rest of the hour, Alan Viard, economist, resident scholar with the American Enterprise Institute, and Jared Bernstein, who is a senior fellow with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about President Obama's budget, which was unveiled yesterday, a $3.8 trillion budget proposal calling for hiking taxes on the rich and spending more on transportation infrastructure and economic stimulus programs. Republicans saying essentially that the budget doesn't have a chance of approval and that President Obama is playing politics and criticizing the president on a number of fronts as the president and Congress will battle over this budget. I should mention that former Speaker Pelosi has, of course, praised the budget and has said that it's balanced, it's fair, it's fiscally responsible. You may have some thoughts about it, and we certainly welcome your thoughts. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or posting any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. Also, post questions or comments on our Facebook page. Spoke earlier with Michael Doyle, reporter with the Washington Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers, and our guest for the hour, Jared Bernstein, who is senior fellow with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Alan Viard, also with us from Washington this morning by phone, is an economist and resident scholar with the American Enterprise Institute and former senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas and a senior economist on the staff of President Council on Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. Let's go right to your calls, and we begin with Karma. Good morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question or comment, I guess, is that I have this thing on my wall with the U.S. federal budget, and it shows that 63% of the U.S. budget is military. So really, I'm just hoping that the commentators can talk about that. And it just seems like whenever the budget's discussed, they don't really talk about the military budget, and it seems to be hands-off. And why is that? Do you think the military budget will be cut? And if not, why is no one talking about that, like, huge chunk of the budget, more than half, that's going to military?
Well, let's talk about it. Jared Bernstein, it seems inevitable that it will be cut, doesn't it?
In fact, the budget does cut it. And when I say cut, I don't just mean slow the rate of growth. The budget cuts the funding for the Department of Defense by about 1%. By the way, I think that with respect to the caller, those numbers sound way too high.
Yeah, they do to me, too.
Yeah, if I can just defense spending is 30%.
It's about 20%.
It's about 25 or 30%, I think.
Yeah, it's about, I think defense is about 20 at insecurity, and then you have security spending around 30, I think, is what you get to. So at any rate, this is a unique moment in this aspect of budgeting, because for the first time in, geez, I think maybe in my lifetime, there does seem to be bipartisan support for pulling back on military spending, for actually military spending to be on the table in a way that it hasn't before. I mean, for a while there, Barney Frank and Ron Paul, two people who live on pretty far different sides of the aisle, were getting together on this point. Of course, as the war spending comes down, that's also going to help the budget in a way we discussed earlier. So I actually think the caller might want to take a look at some of this aspect of the budget. You'd probably feel a little better.
Well, Alan Viard, the fact is, though, that Republicans are saying there's too much cutting going on in defense, aren't they?
Well, we do need to strike a right balance here. So first of all, in terms of the numbers, defense outlays this fiscal year are $709 billion out of total outlays of $3.7 trillion. So you're looking at less than 20% of the budget going to defense. So, you know, if you start from a, you know, just false premise of like 60-some percent going to defense, that's obviously not the way to think about it. And so Jared was quite right to flag that issue. You know, on defense, obviously, as we wind down in Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, that's going to give us some savings. And I think we'll all welcome that because we obviously would like to use that money for other purposes whenever we can do so without undermining our security. It is important, though, not to overreact. And in past history, we've sometimes gone through cycles where when some foreign engagements end, we cut back very aggressively on defense, but then find that we don't have the capacity we may need during future crises and then have to go through a much more expensive rebuilding program. So we have to strike the right balance. But I think there's one thing to just absolutely emphasize in all of this. Defense spending, although it is not a trivial part of the budget, is also not where the long-term fiscal imbalance comes from. The long-term imbalance comes because Medicare, Medicaid, and to a lesser extent Social Security spending is growing much faster than our revenues. And so you've got to tackle that problem first and foremost by looking at Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and revenues. And, of course, if you can get savings in the discretionary part of the budget, defense or non-defense, you know, that's great. If we can find good savings, let's do it. But that should never distract us from looking at entitlements and revenues, which is where the real imbalance comes from.
Well, as I said earlier, there's bound to be some battling over defense budget and also over high-speed rail. And I think our next caller wants to bring up high-speed rail. Chris, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was hoping on asking or directing this question to your panel about federal funds that may have already been allocated to California. I know California voters have already voted and approved a $10 billion bond to be floated to start implementation of high-speed rail here in California. And I know that Californians would like to see it happen, but I just wanted to find out whether or not any monies from the federal government are now threatened, or if any money is now in jeopardy of, you know, not coming to California and making that a reality.
Can we hear from Alan Viard or Jared Bernstein on this?
Well, I mean, this is Jared. I can't speak to California specifically. I do know that there are proposals in this budget for infrastructure that are fairly significant, both for transportation writ large, roads, rails, runways is kind of the way they frame it. And I'm certain
and,
that some
and
of that
highways
is,
and schools, actually, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, schools as well. And sure, some of that will find its way to California.
Let me thank the caller. Any thoughts from you, Alan Viard, on high-speed rail in
yeah,
general?
I guess just a couple of words on that. I mean, obviously every project has to be looked at on its own merits, but I think there's been a lot of doubt raised as to the feasibility of some of the proposals for high-speed rail from an economic perspective. Obviously, you have to look at the locations in question and the other transportation alternatives and so on. The one tendency that sometimes comes up in these issues is that infrastructure spending or defense spending, for example, is pushed as a way to create jobs in the short run. And I think anytime you see any program that's being pushed solely on those grounds, you know, which does not necessarily apply to all these programs, but may apply to some of them, then that's a mistake because these programs are too slow acting to really bring in jobs during an economic downturn. You should only do programs of this kind, defense or non-defense, if there's real, genuine benefits, you know, from the output that these things are going to produce. You know, only if the high-speed rail is actually going to be useful to travelers, only if the defense you know, programs are actually going to promote our security and so on. So the one thing I hope is that they won't be driven by short-run jobs considerations.
Well, you know, you both are sounding so civil and amicable with
well,
one another. I'm just wondering.
Let me respond to that in a civil and amicable but somewhat disagreeable way. Look, we are going to invest a lot more in infrastructure. Alan knows that. I know that. Everyone knows that. We have massive public infrastructure in this country. So the question isn't whether we're going to do it. It's whether we're going to do it smartly. Now, the budget calls for almost $475 billion or so of a six-year surface transportation reauthorization, and some of that is sure to include rail and high-speed rail. In fact, one of the goals explicitly in the budget is to provide 80% of Americans with access to at least passenger rail, and there's going to be high-speed in there, and intercity as well. So, you know, without sort of getting too caught up in where and when and how, I think the best thing to do is accept that these investments will be made because advanced economies need good infrastructure, and think about doing it in a way that's smart, that uses cost-benefit analysis, that works from efficiencies and not from formulas. That's the way to go forward.
Let me go back. I think that's exactly what I was saying. So yeah, I don't think there's any disagreement.
Oh, okay.
Let me go back for a moment to entitlements, and maybe I'll get some more disagreement on that. Not that I'm searching for disagreement here, but Jared Bernstein, I read a piece of yours where you said you talked about the GOP as entitlement wolves in sheep clothing, really going after social programs.
Mm-hmm. Right. Some of what I hear coming from the right, and I think Alan may have described this earlier in talking, I don't remember if it was Alan or Michael, in talking about some of the counterproposals. For example, voucherizing, putting some of these healthcare plans on a voucher. Now, that may actually sound good to people. You get a voucher and you go out and you can shop for your healthcare in, you know, quote, the competitive market for health insurance. Personally, that doesn't sound like a good time to me, but if some people want to do it, so be it. The problem is if that voucher is inadequate, and earlier plans proposed by Paul Ryan, I think, absolutely deserve that label, all you're doing is shifting costs onto the beneficiaries themselves. And in the case of the voucher plan that Representative Ryan proposed, it was estimated to be about a $6,000 per year cost shift onto the individual. That's just a backdoor way to slash away at social insurance programs like health care or retirement security, that ultimately will basically end them as social insurance as we know them. So I think those are terrible ideas.
Alan Viard?
Well, I agree with some of the factual statements that Jared's making. I guess my interpretation of them, my conclusions, may be a bit different. I think that what we have to do on these healthcare programs is to do what Jared calls cost shifting. Now, maybe just get the terminology straight there. I mean, in a free society, we start from the premise that people buy and pay for their own goods and services. And then the question we ask is, in what circumstances do we need to shift those costs to the government? And the answer, of course, is that in some cases, we need to do just that, because we want everybody in this country to get adequate health care, and not everybody can afford it themselves, and the government has to play an important role there. But so the question is, you know, are we shifting too much of the cost to the government? I think as health care costs continue to rise, we absolutely have to demand that the recipients who are better off, the Medicare recipients who have higher incomes, do have to pay more of the cost. And a voucher program or premium support program is exactly one way to do that. It's a different administrative structure, but the real purpose of it is to try to say, yes, we're going to try to scale back the fraction of these costs that the government is paying, increase the fraction that's being paid by those recipients who are able to pay those costs. I think that's absolutely indispensable
if we're going to keep these programs from
just growing at an explosive rate.
But the voucher program, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, at least as Paul Ryan initially presented it, the voucher program is not a program that's just targeted at folks with higher incomes. Those vouchers would go to everyone. And it's actually the middle and the lower income folks who I think would be dinged by this. Now, I don't disagree with you that more cost sharing at the very top of the scale in terms of Medicare may make sense. But he's talking about low income people, middle income people, right?
Well, you have to rely on Medicaid, I think, to provide a safety net for the poor. And I think you can certainly criticize the Congressman Ryan's budget from last year on the Medicaid front. Because if you are going to increase cost sharing under Medicare, you have to have Medicaid as a backdrop. The one thing I would say is I don't think the increased cost sharing can be restricted to the very top of the income distribution. I think
that's
it has
a fair
to
point.
Reach further down. But it does have to spare the people at the bottom. That's absolutely true. I mean, you can't go to some low-income retiree and say, oh, you're going to have to pay a lot more for your health care. Mm-hmm. And I think that fact, and the fact that healthcare costs are rising so rapidly in this country because of technological reasons and demand reasons that we really are not going to be able to change and shouldn't change. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's inevitable, I think, that taxes will have to go up as a share of GDP as we go forward to help pay for these programs. But if we want to mitigate those tax increases, and I think we absolutely have to from the standpoint of economic growth, then increased cost sharing is really the answer. And I think there's ample scope for it under Medicare. You can get there through a voucher program. You could get there within the context of the current administrative structure. So those are both options. But I think we do have to go in that direction. But we do have to keep Medicaid in place as a safety net.
And I want to go to
more. Not everyone on the Republican side does recognize that, I have to admit.
I do want to go to more calls, but let me first read some comments from listeners. Listener writes, Republicans and Democrats should agree on one common good for the nation in the next final budget, a robust public transit in most major U.S. cities, and an inner-city fast train web. This will create real jobs and will alleviate pollution problems and the waste of oil reserves for the next generations. Some of your web comments, and by the way, you can put them on our website just by going to kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. But Jim writes on the web, the biggest problem going forward with the budget is not Medicare and Social Security. It is not being willing to pay for these programs and government in general with taxes. The biggest problem we face is our unwillingness to pay for government. We have the lowest tax rate in the industrial world. Colin says, if Obama had been unable to get Congress to limit the deductibility of charitable contributions for upper-income earners in 2009 when the Democrats had control of both House and Senate, then how does he expect the Republican-controlled House to do away with any of the deductions used by the 1% to minimize their federal income taxes? And Blake writes on the web, Obama, the big spender, has what's called liberal cover, meaning that because his self-marketing campaigns have strongly insisted that he's a liberal, and many people who are superficial thinkers continue to be eager to believe that, largely groundless claim, it follows that anything action that Obama performs that contradicts this appearance is often either ignored or rationalized away, with the extraordinary result being that Obama has been permitted to be more cravenly corporatist and a bigger spender than his predecessor. And we'll go to more of your calls. William? You're on. Good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm a little troubled by what I would call the guests, what you might say, drinking the Kool-Aid of the concept of American exceptionalism. If we look at the rest of the world, there's something, I don't think it's an accident that we spend 20 times as much on military as the next 20 nations combined, and yet we don't have the kinds of public services that that same kind of expenditure could provide if it was directed to the kinds of services that people could use. So I'd appreciate the guest perspective on why we don't look abroad to see where other things have succeeded and then consider applying those principles to our society rather than somehow feeling that we are so very, very special that we can do things in a completely different way, a wasteful way, I believe, and still have a successful society.
Well, we hear from the right that President Obama doesn't believe in American exceptionalism, and we also hear that he's looking to Europe for all kinds of socialist measures. But, Jared Bernstein, let's have you address this first, and then we'll hear from Alan Viard.
Well, I think the I haven't heard Alan or myself invoke American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
So, but I do think that the caller raises a point that I was thinking when Alan said something a few minutes ago, which is absolutely true, which is that look, our big pressures in the budget are not coming from military spending. If you look down the road. But that doesn't mean that the military spending that we're doing is smart or is at the right level or is what we need. Now, everyone, certainly on this station and probably listening to the station, would not want to cut that spending $1 below what makes our nation safe and secure. But there's no reason to assume that the current levels are those levels. And I think what's useful, and I think the caller has a point, I think what's useful about the current time is that people are starting on both sides of the aisle to question whether the level of regardless of the fact of what's putting pressure on the budget down the road, whether the level of military spending is appropriate given the changing nature of external threats. And the president is clearly struggling with that question in this budget. And if you read some of the text, he actually talks about the shifting nature of these threats and why a conventional armed forces may not be the thing that you want to have in place in a world where those changes are occurring.
And Alan Viard.
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly the case that defense spending has to be looked at, but also has to be kept in perspective. Again, today, defense spending makes up 19% of federal spending, and under the president's budget, it shrinks to 13% of the budget during the upcoming decade. So it's not as if defense spending is not being looked at. I mean, obviously, as we withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan, we will have savings in that area of the budget. And Jared is clearly right. I mean, the spending that we have is not necessarily the spending we need. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes we get spending that is not worthwhile because of this jobs argument. And again, it may be in defense. You hear that particular weapon systems or particular military bases should be kept because they create jobs. And, you know, you hear it for infrastructure on the civilian side, too. And those are bad reasons to do spending. So, yeah, by all means, let's, keep looking at this area of the budget. I mean, 19% of the budget is no small item.
Well, let me give you, if
again,
I may,
but
Alan,
let's, but
I'm
let's,
sorry.
We've got to keep the main focus, though, on the imbalance between entitlements and revenues.
I just want to give you another statistic since we're talking about defense. I'm looking at an email here from a listener named Christian who says the U.S. accounted for 44% of global military spending in 2010. Number two is China at 7%. How is that not disproportionate?
Well, the United States has about 20-some percent of world GDP, so obviously the fact that the fraction might be significant is not surprising. I think that question goes to the relationship that the United States has with its allies, and that raises all kinds of foreign policy questions concerning burden sharing and so on. You know, certainly we need to look at ways if we can get more of our allies to pick up the costs. I think that would be ideal. I do think at the end of the day, though, certainly the American people want. I mean, as Jared said, none of us want a dollar less to be spent than is necessary for our security.
Another listener, Robin, writes, why do we talk about SSI, Medicare, Medicaid as entitlements when these are insurance programs that we, the people, fund? We are paying for these costs as taxpayers. Actually, he said praying for these costs. That may be an interesting Freudian slip.
Let me prayer
yeah. Let me get another caller on. Robert, okay. Joining us. Hi, Robert. You're on.
Yeah, I was just looking at the word entitlements. And is farm aid, is that an entitlement? Or
yeah.
Money going to Egypt to fund its military? You know,
no, that's,
things like
the
that.
Foreign aid is discretionary, but the main farm subsidies are entitlements.
Then look at the Senate and Congress. They voted themselves a raise and doubled their salary, and they also get $280,000 in benefits. I went and looked all this stuff up on their webpage.
Yeah, well, it's a worthy point that I'm glad you brought to our attention.
But I think, again, it's just absolutely critical, and I think Jared and I both agree on this, that we keep the attention on where the long-term imbalance comes from. You know, aid to Egypt, congressional salaries, you know, this is not where the imbalance is coming from. And so if we address those things along with addressing the long-term gap between entitlements and revenues, that's great. If we address those things instead of addressing the long-term gap between entitlements and revenues, then, you know, we're really in bad shape. I mean, if my wages for my job are not enough to, you know, to pay for the rent on my house, then I've got to do something about changing, you know, where I live or changing the job I'm doing. And if instead of dealing with those things, you know, I'm looking, you know, going around my living room trying to find, you know, coins underneath the sofa to try to, you know, bring in a dollar here or there, then I'm going to, you know, end up in pretty bad shape. So we've got to really keep the focus on where this imbalance comes
from. Jared, hold that thought for a moment, because I want to remind listeners that you are listening to Forum, and we are talking with Jared Bernstein and Alan VR. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Sorry, Jared, please proceed.
Sounds like everybody needs some revenues. Look, 2 points. One is, one of the callers a second ago, I think it was an emailer, said, why do we call these entitlements? Don't we pay for them? I think that's a good point. On the other hand, the problem is we're not quite paying for them. We're paying for some of them. But if you actually look at where the budget imbalances come from, as we've been stressing, it's very much from healthcare. Social Security is actually something we could fix with a couple of changes that I think would be relatively acceptable to most people. Maybe not most people who work in Congress, but most people who kind of take a rational look at this. But the long-term pressure is from the gap between what we are going to spend on this stuff and the revenues we've set aside for it. And a point that Alan has made throughout, I wanted to amplify now, because Alan, I think, is associated with more the conservative side of this argument, and he's consistently said we need more revenue. Now, this budget that the president released includes $1.5 trillion in new revenue, and one of the reasons Republicans say it's dead on arrival is explicitly because of that. They have refused, many of them have taken a pledge, never to increase taxes, never to add new revenues. And, you know, Alan knows full well, and you heard him say, that that's completely unrealistic, destructive, bad politics, bad economics, and really quite dysfunctional.
And we'll go to more of our callers. We'll go to you, Frederick.
So the one, I could just add just a quick comment here. As Jared says, I do absolutely believe there needs to be more revenue. It's just hard to see anybody can escape that conclusion. But I think the corollary of that is that the president's strategy of taxing only, having tax increases only on the top 2 or 3% of the population is also not viable over the long run. And commentators across the political spectrum have recognized that the tax increases will need to be broader based. Yes, part of the money, of course, will come from those at the top, but it will be necessary to go more broadly.
I have to make one editorial comment. I've said this before on the air, that when I learned civics back in high school, they said that democratic government, our republic, is based on compromise. How can you have compromise when you have people giving a sworn oath to Grover Norquist, that they will not, under any circumstances, raise taxes? It doesn't seem like, at least it's in the spirit of democratic negotiations. There's my editorial comment for the day.
Yeah, no, I think that pledge is going to have to be abandoned, obviously. It's misguided.
Let me get Frederick on here. Frederick, go.
Michael, perfect timing for me. I wanted to speak to Mr. Bernstein. Is it Bernstein? I'm sorry.
Jared Bernstein is with us, and Alan Viard, right.
Yeah. As a liberal, and you're representing a liberal economic institution, I'd like you to highlight, as you have just done in this last 5 minutes of the program, that we must raise revenue. And I would take exception to the commentator's comment that the revenue enhancement must be broad-based. No, I say that the revenue enhancement lies at the wealthiest of the individuals. Our society was made during the 1950s and 1960s with a marginal income tax rate that was, during Eisenhower years, at 91%. Today, the wealthiest pay 35% if they pay that. Corporations are making record profits basically due to overseas production, and they're paying lower tax rates than they have in our lifetime. So, Mr. Bernstein, I'd like you to highlight in future conversations that we must have as much of a conversation on the revenue enhancement on those people that can pay as you do focus on the cuts to entitlements, which I believe ought to be off
Frederick,
the table.
Frederick, very well said. I'm with you all the way. And as you heard a minute ago, I lean into that pretty hard. But let me say two things and ask Alan a question. I take Alan's point that it's going to be impossible to raise the revenues we need based on a few percent. But you've got to start somewhere. And it seems that right now it's very smart, especially in a climate where this excessive income inequality is finally getting the attention it deserves. I think that this is a very smart place to start. Now, Alan, I'm sure you've seen literature. You've probably contributed to it on rates of taxes that we could raise on high-income people. I'm thinking of work by an economist out there in California named Emmanuel Saez that says you could actually raise the tax rate on very high-income people to levels that were not unlike the ones Frederick was citing, and you'd raise a lot more revenue, and you wouldn't have the kind of distortions that I know people like you worry about. What do you think?
Well, he doesn't say that there'd be no distortions. I mean, he argues that in his framework that it would be worthwhile to do that, even though you would have some distortions. I mean, obviously, you're always going to get some disincentives when you raise taxes. One key point, though, which just has to be stressed, is his model really is looking at the tax as just a distortion of the decision on working and on earning taxable income in any given year, and doesn't look at the impact on saving and investment. So it'd be more applicable, I think, if you were talking about some type of progressive consumption tax, and you can't really map that into a conclusion about today's income tax system, which does also have this corrosive effect on saving and investment.
That's going to have to bring things to a conclusion. We've ended the program. Thanks to Alan Viard from the American Enterprise Institute, Jared Bernstein from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and we also spoke with Michael Doyle of McClatchy Newspapers. Thank you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Ferro, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.